So what I want to do today is just give a brief review of where observational cosmology, I guess, stands, and tell you about some things that might happen in the future, like, for example, measurements of hydrogen through its 21-centimeter line at high redshift that might add a lot to what we know about our universe. But so let's start with some simple introduction. So clearly, in the last century or so, there is a huge progress in what we know observationally about our universe. If you just compare just the cartography, the maps that people were producing or produced of the universe at different times, it's just outside, just incredible. So at the beginning, people were just looking at stars and trying to count stars in different directions and trying to figure out how big the universe was in different directions by seeing how many stars they saw. And roughly speaking, they were just seeing local stars in our own galaxy, and they would just think the universe was larger in one direction than the other, just because of obscuration in our own galaxy. So they were just mapping the local properties of the star distribution around us. And in a century now, we have detailed maps of most of our Hubble volume. We'll talk about that later. At the very beginning of the history of the universe, we can know through WMAP how the density was distributed, at least a snapshot in time. We can see this at different times and structure growing, etc. So it's come an incredibly long way in this century. And we've entered what usually people call the era of precision cosmology, in which we now can print out tables with numbers, with digits, and all of this kind of stuff, which was unthinkable some time ago for cosmologists. There is this quote that I think is apocryphal, but I think it's still some people think it's real. I mean, I think the content is kind of real, and whether or not Landau did actually say it, it doesn't really matter. But I think this view of what cosmology was had some truth to it, but I think it's less and less reasonable to take that view. And I think for the most part nowadays, when we give these tables, we really believe and think we know what we're talking about. And those error bars mean something, and usually things will not be far away from those numbers. So we've come a very long way. Exactly. So if you ask, then maybe it continues.
No, he said astrophysicists.
Okay, astrophysicists. Is this more true for astrophysicists than for cosmologists?
Is he talking about anybody in particular?
Anyhow, so of course, even though now we can, so basically we can characterize our universe pretty well. We have a model with basically six parameters that fits all our observations very, very well. And so we are in pretty good shape. But of course, many of those things in this model are not particularly, or we haven't gotten to the bottom of it, of them. For example, we have a description of the universe that involves dark matter and dark energy as their main constituents, and we would like to learn more about it. This model relies on, so the way we think structure forms is through gravitational instability. We understand pretty well why fluctuations are unstable. We can calculate the growth rate at different periods. We can match these two observations, roughly speaking. And this seems to work, but we still need to have some initial inhomogeneities that grow through structure formation, through gravitational instability. So we need to understand though where they were coming from. So there are still issues there, and trying to convince ourselves really that the picture of those primordial fluctuations produced, say, by inflation, as we think it happened, is actually what did happen in our universe. And of course, there's plenty of problems that have to do more with nonlinear physics and astrophysics. So the further on we go in the history of the universe, the more and more difficult it is for us to calculate certain things. For example, when exactly the first galaxies we expect them to form, their properties, the properties of galaxies in our current time, et cetera, et cetera. They're all things that we can try to calculate, but we are not particularly good at it, or there are still issues when we compare with observations. So in terms of the matter content, we know that the universe is flat, so the curvature of surfaces of constant time is flat. We've determined that with quite a good precision, both the combination of WMAP and other experiments. And what I want to focus my time more in this talk, at the beginning at least, is not so much the description of the matter content of the universe, but more what we have learned and what we want to learn about the initial time in the universe and the epoch of inflation, and how these initial perturbations that grow to form the structure that we see came about. We can then use our model allows us to calculate how the universe expands, how structure forms, etc. But it still needs some initial conditions, if you want, and those initial conditions come in the form of a spectrum of density perturbations. The universe has to start not perfectly homogeneous. It needs to have a small departures from homogeneity, and we know roughly how they should be. They should basically be almost the same amount of fluctuations on every physical scale, and that's what inflation predicts, and at some level, and it's also what we observe. But if we want to test the details of the mechanism that we think is responsible for generating those perturbations, we want to study them in detail, and the windows that we have into studying this epoch of the formation of the creation of these density perturbations are basically measuring in detail whether or not the perturbations in the initial conditions were the same size of perturbations on every physical scale, whether or not there's a background of gravitational waves, whether or not these initial perturbations are well described by a Gaussian probability distribution. And other possibilities, for example, are what are called isocurvature modes. So we, at the moment, it's a very good description to think that if in a certain region of the universe at the beginning was overdense, it was overdense in all the species. So if there was more photons, there's more dark matter particles, more neutrinos, by the same, the fluctuations in the number of these particles are the same, the relative fluctuations for every species. So that describes perfectly our universe, but could it be the case that there are fluctuations in composition from place to place? At the moment, we have no evidence for that, but that might be a hint of how those, if we found them, might be a hint of the mechanism that created the perturbations. And also maybe some relics, maybe from the end of inflation, some strings or some defects produced, if they are there, might be a hint. But for the most part, I will talk about the first three things for the beginning of the talk. For the purpose of generating the initial conditions, how does inflation work? So in inflation, what we have is a period of accelerated expansion, and the key point for creating the perturbations is the fact that if you take the ratio of the Hubble size of the universe, so at any given time, A is the scale factor of the universe, the rate A dot is the rate at which the universe is expanding. So there is a characteristic time in the universe, A dot over A, or the inverse of A dot over A, that gives you the expansion rate of the universe. And if you compare that with the size, so for example, imagine that you create a perturbation of a given size, this because of the expansion of the universe, the size of that perturbation grows with the scale factor A. So the size of a perturbation that you create at some time is different at a later time because A is increasing. If you take the ratio between the Hubble distance, the inverse of this expansion rate, and a perturbation, what happens during the normal evolution in normal cosmology, Freeman, Robertson, Walker cosmology, is that the Hubble radius increases with time. This axis is time faster than perturbations get large, become larger because of the scale factor. And so if you take a perturbation back in time, you discover that as you go back in time, a particular size of perturbation is larger than what would be the observable universe at that time. So for example, if we create a perturbation of a 1 megaparsec size that will then eventually form a cluster of galaxies, if you go back in time, that 1 megaparsec scale is getting smaller, but it's getting smaller not as slow as the age of the universe is getting smaller. So there comes a time in which the age of the universe is shorter than that size. And so if you want to create a perturbation of 1 megaparsec size to create a cluster, you have two choices. You can either, if there is, in normal cosmology, would be from this diagram in this direction, you should wait until the size of this perturbation is smaller than the observable universe at the time and rearrange the matter so that you put more here and a cluster will form. Or if not, you have to change this picture such that the size of the observable universe or the Hubble rate, say, changes its slope such that the perturbation sometime back into the past was again inside or smaller than the rate of expansion. And so you can create the perturbations at this time. So inflation does this and creates perturbations at this time. So you have two options. You either create, you change the standard FRW evolution of the universe so that you have a period where you can create perturbations in the very beginning. Or you can create the perturbations as you go along of different scales. You can create them after they enter the horizon in the normal Friedman-Robertson-Walker evolution. By now, we know for a fact that perturbations cannot be created and look the way they look if they are created in this particular way. So we are sure that a period, if not inflation, something very much like inflation in that perturbations were, for all practical purposes of the FRW evolution, an initial condition. So our standard universe starts here, and we have to have put these perturbations in place before that yeah.
This last statement there, things coming out, for example, with cyclic universes. Where they claim that you can't get the perturbations.
Yes. Very nice. What should I say?
He's a racist, but I feel it.
Yeah, no, it's fine. So let me say that for the purpose of my argument that I've just said, whether this you take this module of output inflation or you take this other whatever ekpyrotic scenario is the same. The perturbations are in place by the time you start the Big Bang. What we would call, in their case, there are many baby Big Bangs in cyclic, but let's take the last one. And when you reheat the universe and start the normal FRW phase, all the perturbations are in place in that scenario, as well as in inflation. So for the purpose of this discussion, they are the same. And so I don't have to say whether or not I think that is a viable or a nice alternative. I can just say it's the same. So how do we know that? We know that by studying the cosmic microwave background and looking at the spectrum of fluctuations. So this is a plot. So this is the map of the temperature in the sky by WMAP. I'm sure you've seen this before. And this is a plot of the amount of fluctuations as a function of scale. This is scale. This is small scales. This is large scales. And this, let's look at the top one. So this is just the level of fluctuations, the typical amplitude of Fourier modes of the wavelength given by this, where this is the L of the spherical harmonic as a function of scale. And this pattern of peaks, and in particular also this pattern of peaks here, this is for the temperature, and this is for the polarization temperature correlation, which measures the velocity of the fluid at the last scattering surface. This negative value here implies that inflation or something has to have happened in the initial condition. And let me tell you how that goes. So first of all, for most people, just seeing the peaks was good enough. And the reason was that if you imagine particular scenarios of inflation, a particular alternative to inflation, like cosmological defects that would, as cosmic strings that would move around, steer matter around, and create the perturbations. If you did the calculation of what you would expect for this power spectrum, you would get something like this, which has no peaks in it, as we have observed. So by the time the peaks were created, were seen, we knew that the perturbations were not caused by at least specific examples of causal seeds like defects. And the reason why this happens is that the fact these perturbations have peaks boil down to the fact that all Fourier modes of a given wavelength are in phase. So for example, if you consider a particular wavelength at the time of recombination, which is when we see these maps, all the modes of a given wave number are in phase. They're all either in a maximum or in a minimum. And this can be traced to the fact that they are all set with their values at some particular time by inflation in these initial conditions. However, if you the cosmic defects do not do that. They create perturbations all the time, which are not even correlated. Of course, if you look in one direction on the sky, or very some other direction, so they would not be in phase, and they do not have the peak, and they also produce a lot of perturbations coming from gravitational waves and vector modes, and so those also do not have peaks. So by the time you put together, the spectrum would never have peaks or never had peaks when they were done by cosmic defects. However, that was not at the level of the theorem, and now it's pretty much at the level of the theorem because of this negative value in the cross correlation. So imagine that you wanted to mimic what you see in inflation with some causal mechanism. What you would need to do, you have a universe that's homogeneous, and you consider a scale that's becoming of the size of the horizon. When it's inside, when it's inside the horizon, so that some causal mechanism can create a perturbation, you rush matter into some point, into some place, and create the perturbation, and then let it go, and not touch it again, so it would evolve like a perturbation that nobody is sourcing, which is the case of inflation. So defects source perturbations all the time as they move around, and that's why they wash out the peaks. But if you manage to have a way of rushing matter to some place and then immediately at the time of horizon crossing and then let it go, then you would create something that has peaks and looks, you can make it look very close to like that. So at the level of the theorem, you might wake around it, but that's not the case with polarization. Polarization pretty much measures the velocity of the fluid. So imagine that you wanted to create a perturbation here. In the case of inflation, the perturbation starts in this region, and when it comes inside the horizon, this region is overdense, matter wants to flow out of the region. On the other hand, if you had a universe that was homogeneous and you wanted to create the perturbation at the time of horizon crossing, you would need to rush matter into this region to first create the perturbation, and then you let it go. So exactly at the time of horizon crossing, the velocities have the opposite sign, just because if you want to create it out of nothing, you have to bring the stuff in. There's no way around it, okay? While if you have it there from the initial condition, it's there and the stuff wants to get out. So there's a sign always different in the divergence of the velocity relative to the density. And the pressure and the polarization measures the divergence of the velocity, and this, because of conventional reasons, this minus sign at the scale of the horizon at decoupling points to this case versus this case. So now we know velocities where the divergence was like this instead of like that, so end of story. We have to believe that the perturbations were put at the very beginning, okay? So we know that, and now we want to know, so we know there's some period here where perturbations were created, so now by studying perturbations of different size, we might infer what was happening during inflation at different times. And the first thing to look at is whether or not the amount of
Actually, was that an example that would give you a positive correlation between
that positive for the defects? Yeah.
No, for defects.
Or for like the case.
For what you're describing.
Yeah, exactly. This is more old papers.
What kind of a model is that?
So you just allow yourself the freedom of making a source, sourcing the perturbations. Just you need to specify the correlation function of the source of perturbations, and you only have to demand causality. Mm-hmm. And so then this correlation has to be, for example, zero. The two places are separated by outside the light cone, and so on. But you by writing you can find forms for this function that would give that. And this, for example, Neil Turok gave some. At the time, there was this story is a kind of an old story. I think it's a cute story, sort of thing. So,
shouldn't it be negative for all the L's below 100 or negative go positive again?
This? Because now, once you have, once the mode has entered the horizon, you have acoustic oscillations, and so then the
but the other way for lower L.
This part over here,
yeah,
this comes from reionization.
Oh.
So this, if you had no, then this would go to zero. In fact, okay, so the other question is whether or not the spectrum of perturbations is scale invariant, so the same level of perturbations on every scale. And typically, so the size of perturbations is usually called the P of K. So for a given wave number, there is a size of perturbations. And in the case of inflation, there is an expectation because so the reason why we might expect perturbations to be scale invariant, at least in this picture, is that the properties of the size of perturbations as a function of scale have to do of what was happening or is related to what was happening during inflation at the time when the perturbation was of the size of the horizon during inflation. So to the extent that inflation is close to the Sitter space and everything is the same as a function of time, then you would expect exactly scale invariant perturbations or close to scale invariant perturbations. But inflation has to end. That's the one part that we know about inflation for sure. It's there. It has to end. And so things cannot be all the same as a function of time. And so typically, you always get that you get a change in the size of perturbations, of the size of 1 over the number of e-folds of inflation from the time our perturbations were created to the end of inflation. And so that typical size can, this is usually called n minus 1, and it's typically of that size, or 0.05 or something like that. Yeah? Do we assume a high K cutoff? No, why?
Because it's necessary, otherwise the statistical power diverges.
It's true. If it's scale invariant, if it goes on forever, it diverges both in the IR and the infrared. The IR, you don't really necessarily care because that's just our redefinition of the mean parameters of the universe. On small scales, yeah, if inflation went on forever, but it's long, right? So anyway, you have to keep going. For 10 to minus 5, you need 10, you need the log. You have to have a lot of inputs, right? 10 to 5. To have a problem. So for practical purposes, I don't necessarily worry about it. We also know that the number, even you can change the heating temperature quite substantially, but we never get from the time our horizon crossed the horizon during inflation till the end, we never had 10 to the 5 before. So you can argue between 60 and 30 or more. Never. So these type of expectations, typically experiments in cosmology measure a range of scales, maybe for the case of WMAP, that vary by a factor of 400. So this is a 30%, the expectation is a 30% change in the size of power between the smallest and the largest scale. Given the size of the error bars in those plots that I show you, it's very reasonable that we should be able to be making these kind of measurements, and we are. The only difficult, this seems like very easy to see. The only reason it's not so easy is that they're fitting like 6 parameters at the time, so we can sometimes have a 30% change coming from somewhere else and trade things to one region. And so at the current time, this is from WMAP 5-year parameter measurement of this NS. 1 is scale invariant, and this is their likelihood function. And so it is preferring a red tilt, and with the it's not liking scale invariant perturbations, so things are consistent with what one might naively expect from inflation. But the important thing is that this is getting much, much better in the near future. Experiments like, for example, Planck will so for a scalar n of 0.95, which this is a simulation in this paper, but this would be the difference between the scale invariant and the n of 0.95, and the error bars are what W the size of error bars of WMAP, these are the size of error bars of Planck. So it will, in the future, we will, now it's a pretty compelling case, but in the future it will get just nailed. Yeah?
How sensitive are these going to be between a slightly red tilt and a running of the parameter n with scale?
So, of course, when you're fitting parameters, the more parameters you fit, you expand the range of things that are allowed. And so error bars do increase if you fit for two things, with both things at the time. From a theoretical perspective, just from the in inflation, you expect a running of order n minus 1 square, or 1 over the number of defaulting squares. So if you put that prior, you shouldn't be seeing this at all. So
therefore, it's a test.
Yeah, so at the moment, if you fit for those two parameters, the running is consistent with 0, all the errors blow up a little bit. And so far, so good. Of course, the error bars on this running are going to get much better, not just from this, but also combining with things on smaller scales. And it will be definitely a test of whether or not it's there is this scaling between the slow road scaling, that n minus 1 is order slow road parameters, and the running is slow road parameter square, and so on. We will know for sure. If it's, at the moment, it's consistent with that, but the error bar on the running is much larger than slow road parameter square, so it's not yet a test. The other question is whether there is a stochastic background of gravitational waves, and that is just related. The amplitude of gravitational waves is just related to the Hubble constant during inflation divided by the Planck scale, and if this happens to be of the size of 10 to the minus 5, then they would in the CMB. Make a comparable contribution to the density fluctuations. So if the Hubble constant is as large as that during inflation, then we should be able to see these gravitational waves. At the moment, there are constraints on this already, and they're basically coming from the fact that what we see in the CMB temperature power spectrum would be the sum of the contribution from density perturbations and gravitational waves, and you can fit for those two amplitudes at the same time and try to constrain. So what we see would be the sum of these two curves, so you can add one plus a little bit of the other and see how much of the tensors, just based on the fact that they have a different shape, how much of tensors you would allow. And this is getting quite interesting, I would say. So this is constraints from WMAP in the plane of the departures from scale invariant, and the amount, the ratio between these two curves that are around this point. The green curve is the contribution to the temperature anisotropies, the power spectrum of the temperatures anisotropies, just coming from gravitational waves. And the reason it goes down is that
that's the maximum one.
The two shapes, if R equals 1, the two shapes have the same amount. And as you decrease R, you bring this down as much as you can. Eventually, you can. So basically, if this is 20%, it's allowed because you wouldn't be able to tell, which this is what this is saying. But there is some correlation when you fit these things with other parameters, in particular the tilt. And this, for example, is the current constraint, so you should live in this region. And for like for illustration, they put some examples of inflationary models where they lie in this plane, and some things are not so good, and some things are still there. Of course, no. Yeah.
Does it trouble you that standard inflation models has an unnatural fine tuning in lambda? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so, and in fact, you might argue that for all these models that have large gravitational waves, they require, in order for large in the sense of observable, they require that the field moves by more than a Planck scale during the, and this, I'm told, is not so good, and you can never find this flat direction so large, and so you don't expect to see this, and so we will go out there, see if we can see them, and if we see them, then that argument doesn't hold much water, okay? But
when you fit delta t over t,
yeah,
lambda is 10 to the minus 14.
For this model, yeah. So I'm, of course, the issues of whether these models are natural or unnatural probably most of them are quite unnatural, okay? So, and all of them have problems like the fields have to be quite light for, I mean, they have to have mass much smaller than Hubble in order for even to have quantum fluctuations, and you naturally get at least a mass of order Hubble. So I agree, but there's not much.
Are there any experimental constraints on the Hubble scale being much smaller, like, for example, weak scale?
I would think that I would experimental constraints. I think as long as you reheat the universe way before BBN, you're safe. Okay. Of course. Anyway, so you're not now. Inflation no longer solves your flatness problem or horizon problem, because you have to start with a Hubble constant that's so large that you already start with a very big universe. But I don't know, that's the other type of considerations, not experimental ones. But in the future, we will probably know much better about gravitational waves, not from measurements of the temperature and trying to fit the two shapes, but by measuring the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. That's what experimentalists want to do now. It turns out that the polarization in the microwave background is linearly polarized. If you measure in detail the pattern of polarization on the sky, those patterns can be decomposed into what's the equivalent of a gradient pattern and a curl pattern, and you can show, so this is an example of a curl pattern of polarization. So this pixel of the sky can polarize like this pixel of the sky like that. So clearly, this you would call a curl, and you can show that you cannot have patterns like this around any point if you only have density fluctuations. So people are trying to measure the polarization with very high fidelity in order to be able to split it into the gradient piece and the curl piece, try to see if they see any curl piece, and in that way measure the presence of gravitational waves. So there are a lot of experiments, but let me move on. That's the other big push of experimentalists. And another thing that people have been trying to test is whether or not the fluctuations are Gaussian, the distribution is Gaussian, and it's the case that the simplest models of inflation with just one field predict very small departures from Gaussianity that should not be observable. On the sky, but it is also true that things that are not the simplest might give observable non-Gaussianities, and people have started to look for those. At the moment, mainly there is upper limits, except for there's some. So it turns out. Let me see. So let me just say very, very quickly, I talked a little bit about this yesterday, so I don't want to, I mean, some of you were already there, so I don't want to repeat what I said. But so in a Gaussian random field, Fourier modes of different wave numbers are independent, and it turns out that there are two types of correlations between Fourier modes that you could imagine producing during inflation, we think. One of them is where the value of long wavelength modes determines whether or not on small scales in that region. So imagine the universe where there's a long wavelength mode, here's over dense, here's under dense. And you ask the question whether or not the small scale power the fluctuations on small scales in this region are different statistically from this region. So they fluctuate more here than there, or vice versa. So that's one thing that you might imagine happening, and there are models that predict such things. And the other one is fluctuations that correlate three Fourier modes of the same wave number. And just to give you a sense of what the simplest models of inflation with just one field predict, they do not predict any of these, and you can easily connect the amplitude that you expect for that with what we have already seen for the departures from scale invariant through an argument by Maldacena. And basically, for simple models of inflation, if you were to just calculate the three-point function of the density, for example, delta cubed divided by delta squared to the 3/2, so a dimensionless number, you would get of the order of 10 to the minus 5 times the departure from scale invariance. So this is typically 10 to minus 7, very small for us to see. In comparison, the current constraint for something like this from WMAP, even from the five-year data, is around 10 to minus 2. So simple inflationary models predict very little non-Gaussianity. With an ultimate CMB experiment, you might get to a number of 10 to minus 4 or so. So you don't expect to be able to see what the simplest inflationary model might predict. Other examples exist which predict more. No, barely. Like we have not yet been able to calculate, or nobody has calculated in full generality what those are. In the language of FNL, expectation is FNL of order 1. In some limits, we have been able to calculate, so for a squeeze limit, for example, we have been able to calculate it is indeed like the equivalent of FNL of 0.7 or so. And ultimate CMB, people say it's FNL of a few, like 5 to 10, so we shouldn't be able to see it. But we haven't calculated the three-point function in all generality.
Is this the three-point function of gravitational waves?
That is even smaller. So this is just from the fact that the GR equations are nonlinear, the fact that the physics of recombination is nonlinear. So even once you have, even if you have fluctuations that are Gaussian, what you see is a nonlinear function of that, and so you would get higher moments. In some cases, using the exact same Malthusian argument, you can show in the squeeze limit how it should be, taking into account all the nodes, so this we have done. And then inside, when the three modes are inside the horizon, it gets more tricky because it's a lot of terms.
What about the three first year?
Yeah, sorry. I mean, at the level, of course, you have to be very careful about the coefficients here. At the level of this transparency, 5 years and 3 years is the same.
Yeah,
but, you know, there is an improvement of a factor of a few, but this is like order of magnitude, so it doesn't show. Let me just say the following. So basically, there are these two different ways in which we can imagine inflation producing large non-Gaussianities. One is in which you produce these perturbations that this correlation between modes of different scales, and this can only be accomplished if you have a scalar field producing the perturbations that's not the inflation. You can prove that. And so if we were to observe those fluctuations, it would be pretty fundamental because it would tell us that we have to have another scalar field for sure that is producing the perturbations different from the inflaton. And the other one, in models in which there's just one inflaton field, you can produce correlations between modes of the same size. And this is just a causality argument, so there's no way around this statement that I've just made. It turns out that basically this type of non-Gaussianity measures the sound speed of perturbations during inflation. So so frequency omega square k square, but there might be sound speed. The waves in the perturbations during inflation might travel at a speed distance different than the speed of light, and if that's the case, you enhance non-Gaussianities, and you can see this. And we've searched for both of them using WMAP, and basically at the moment there's just upper limits of both, except for a claim detection of non-Gaussianity of this local shape, the one that implies there are more than one scalar field. So with the WMAP 3-year data, there was a claim detection by a group, not WMAP, a different group. Using WMAP, the public WMAP data. It seems to have gone away with the new release of data from WMAP, but it still, I think, deserves to be looked at more carefully. So I think at the moment, it seems there's nothing there, but there's still, the WMAP year, the 5 years have not been out there long enough for enough people to take a look and decide what's going on. So summary so far, if we wanted to learn about inflation, there are the three things that I talked about were the departure from scale invariant, the gravitational waves, departure from Gaussianity. We seem to be seeing this at the level expected, and it's the measurement will be get much better even at the level of testing whether we should see some running or not. There are upper limits on the background of gravitational waves that are already getting interesting, and polarization experiments already on the ground will make significant improvements on those constraints. And then departures from Gaussianity, we basically, at the moment, there may be some hints, but nothing definite. To make it better, we really need to wait for a bigger data set, which means wait for Planck. So in the remaining of the talk, I want to now move into something more for the future, which is using a different tool. So basically, all of our constraints on cosmological parameters and inflation and what have you, they all come from mapping our universe, trying to understand how structure grows and extrapolate that back to understand the properties of the initial conditions of those structures, and from there try to connect to whatever the source was that produced these fluctuations. And so we will always make progress if we can map bigger regions of the universe and basically map the large scale. Our statements, our statistical statements, we can only predict the statistical properties of the perturbation. So the bigger the sample, the smaller the error bars, basically. So there is a potential of observing a much bigger region of the universe using the 21 centimeter line of hydrogen. This is a highly futuristic subject. Not the existence of a 21 centimeter line of hydrogen, nor its detection in the local universe. All of that is, of course, not futuristic at all. But having the sensitivity to observe neutral hydrogen at very high redshifts, that is futuristic. But people think that it might be doable. And just to give you a sense of scale, so this is like a two-dimensional version of our Hubble volume. So to scale, drawn to scale. So this is the CMB comes from redshift of 1,000. It maps a thin shell around us, so we know what the density was in this thin shell around us. This is by comparison the size of this. Each point actually is a galaxy from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So this is our mapping of the local distribution of matter. But you can see that with galaxies we've mapped a very small portion, and with the CMB we only have a small surface, or a big surface, but it's just a surface at one particular point. And we basically have not mapped most of the Hubble volume. And the amount of measurements that you can make just grows with the volume. So the region that is in principle available to observe the distribution of matter using the 21 centimeter line is this region in light blue. So it's a huge volume. It's the largest chunk of our Hubble patch that we might imagine measuring. And the way it works, as you know, the ground state of hydrogen is split into this hyperfine split into two levels. The wavelength of the transition is 21 centimeter. Basically what happens is the following. If you have neutral hydrogen in the universe and the population of these levels is such that the corresponding temperature that describes the population is different from the CMB temperature, then these neutral hydrogen atoms would either absorb more CMB photons than they emit, or emit more CMB photons than they absorb. So basically, you can detect the presence of this cloud just because you can measure the redshift at which you're seeing the 21 centimeter line, and so you can see whether there are neutral hydrogen atoms in your line of sight with a temperature. If they are neutral and they have a temperature different than the CMB, and you can find that out. Yeah.
Question here. Why is the Sloan survey limited to that very near region around us? Why can't we see further?
The reason we typically are limited is just that things that are further away are fainter. So we need a bigger telescope in order to find them and take spectra of them. So we can also go by making our telescopes bigger and bigger. That's another option. And however, eventually you come a time in which there is no galaxies. So that when that happens, is probably somewhere around here. So if you had the most powerful telescope that you might want to have, you might imagine mapping out galaxies in this region before the blue. There would be galaxies and quasars and the like. I mean, we don't know exactly when the first one formed. I'm just making a rough guess, but then you would have a big volume.
So the blue region here contains, this is from a pre-galaxy regime. You've got a lot of hydrogen.
Exactly.
And that's somehow brighter?
So you now see it in absorption. It's in another frequency band. And the definition of brighter also involves how you observe it and other. So it's detectable depending on how far I get, but you can, in order to detect this, we would need humongous telescopes. But in the radio waves, you can imagine building them, while you could not imagine building them well.
How far back could you see a very redshifted supernova?
A very redshifted supernova.
Can you see it in the infrared?
Yeah. The question is, when is it bright enough? So people, of course, now measure supernovas to redshift around 1. I presume that it just goes with your collecting area. So if you just make the telescope larger, you can, but and down by distance square and 1 plus Z. So, redshift of a few with the next generation of telescopes, we might see. But also, you should realize this also goes not just with the size of the telescope, but with the amount of time you point the telescope in some particular direction to observe this object, right? So when you point to the supernova, you have your telescope that has this little field of view and it's looking at the supernova for quite a while. If you wanted to measure this whole thing, you should repeat this observation over the whole sky. Mm-hmm. So that's not so easy, okay? So in the case of this hydrogen type of experiments, you can build telescopes that look at the whole sky pretty much at the same time. So you can imagine if there's times in the history of the universe in which there's a lot of hydrogen, and this hydrogen, the population levels is not corresponding to the spin temperature, the spin temperature does not correspond to the CMB temperature, then these hydrogens, you could see them. And you can work out during what period of the universe this happens, and basically the basic answer, just to be fast, is so there's a lot of neutrons. So today most of the hydrogen is ionized by the light produced by the stars and so on, and by all the sources of UV radiation in our universe. So you have to go to the period of time before the first stars form, and there then you have a lot of neutral hydrogen, and in that period of time, for the most part, we believe that the spin temperature is different from the CMB temperature, so the hydrogen should be observable during most of the time. And basically, this C of 50, it's cut off because when the density of the universe is high enough, everything is in thermal equilibrium. The temperature of the gas, the spin temperature, and CMB temperature, they are all the same, so you cannot see anything. And these are all collisional processes, so as you go back in time, densities are higher. Eventually, all these rates are much faster than Hubble, and all the temperatures are the same. And so even though there's a lot of neutral hydrogen here, it becomes invisible to us. But there's this big window. So there are experiments that are going to go after this hydrogen. And for the most part, they are focusing, because at the beginning is the easiest thing to do, into the last part, at the beginning here is exactly the time in which the first sources of light are turning on and ionizing the hydrogen. That's the first time, say, when the universe is 50-50, hydrogen, neutral, and ionized. That's the closest region to us, that it's the easiest one to observe, and these experiments, that's what they are going to focus at the beginning, with the hope of later mapping out the bigger region. And of course, the part that where the hydrogen is half and half, and this means that that understanding what's going on is going to be polluted by a lot of astrophysics, because you have to understand the sources and so on to try to deconvolve some cosmology from it. It's quite interesting from an astrophysics point of view, but let me not talk about this for this audience. But the first experiments will basically be looking at that, and if they work, they will move further and further back. Okay. So let me just let me show you two things. So this is just a simulation of a box in the universe. The first source is turning on, so all the hydrogen is at the beginning neutral. You will see some sources of light turning on, and when it's white, it means the hydrogen in that region is ionized. And so there's, at the end of these dark ages, there is this period of bubbles in which they carve out hydrogen. And the first experiments are trying to go after this epoch, in which there'll be big contrasts between one place and the other one, because some places are fully ionized, some places are fully neutral. But so the signal is slightly bigger at the time, and but it's mainly astrophysics. But it's like the training ground to get to the higher redshift, if you want. So let me just for fun tell you a little bit about this experiment, so that you have a sense of what needs to be accomplished. Roughly speaking, these differences in intensity that you would see in this 21 centimeter line are at the level of 20 millikelvin when you work it out. The sky at those frequencies, it's like a black body at 200 Kelvin. Okay? So this is a 10 to minus 4 effect. So it's a pretty small effect, but if you compare it with the CMB is at 3 Kelvin. The temperature fluctuations are 10 to minus 5. The E-mode polarization that people have already observed is at 10 to minus 6. We're talking about looking at these gravitational waves that are at the 10 to minus 8 level. So this is the CMB. 10 to minus 4 looks like a piece of cake, right? Why hasn't it been done already? Well, the reason is that it's just a question of scaling. So of course, if you could make as big a telescope for the CMB and wait as long for this kind, where you scale the time by the frequency and the size of the telescope by the wavelength, then you would be fine. It would be the same. But these the CMB experiments are 100 gigahertz wavelength, 0.3 centimeters, and you have like this bigger telescope maybe. But now we are talking about wavelengths 21 centimeters, redshifted maybe to 2 meters, frequencies of 140 megahertz. So if you were to be able to scale things by the lambda square and frequency, then yes, but this means making a huge telescope and waiting for quite a while. So that's the challenge. And so people are talking about building these big telescopes. The other thing that you should notice is that 140 megahertz, it might sound familiar. It's like FM radio, okay? So that's the other problem. So the way people are thinking about making these huge telescopes is not to actually build a huge telescope, because you need like a 1 kilometer square kind of collecting area, but to make it out of simple, you know, in the radio at 140 megahertz, you can receive these radio waves with simple antennas. Just put a lot of them, record the electric field from all of these antennas, the actual electric field, send it into a computer and try to recreate a telescope. And that's the key that has happened, is that computationally it's now feasible to record this electric field that is coming at this high 140 megahertz, and record all of the signals from all of these hundreds and hundreds of antennas, send it to a computer, and basically recreate what a full telescope would see. It's a matter of the Moore's law, basically. That's why people now think they can do it, and not in the past. It's not something about the actual antennas having to be more sophisticated, or the receiver themselves. All of this is pretty simple technology. It's the computer that should do the calculations. That is the another big problem is radio frequency interference. This is what we are using all these frequencies for in the US. That correspond to neutral hydrogen at redshift 2 to redshift 7, so FM radio. So It's all used up, so you don't want to do it here, okay? So experiments are going to faraway places like desert in Australia, where there's, you know, a 0.01 human per kilometer square, so not too much frequency. So they think of the idea is to build this big array of telescopes in a very distant location and try to do this experiment. And early things have already happened. Like this is for there's one experiment that Harvard is involved in, and it's putting these simple dipoles, lots of them, on the ground, and they've put a couple and see that they have worked. And because they are dipoles, they are sensitive to all the sky at the same time. If you put a dipole, the response is very so isotropic. So you can make maps of a very large chunk of the sky, and you can imagine mapping this full Hubble volume. And the last thing that I wanted to show you is also I found some old study from NASA. So basically, you need like a 1 kilometer square kind of telescope that you can think on the ground of making it by like that. But this guy was talking about in the 60s about flying a 1 kilometer square in space telescope. And you might think this is impossible. It will weigh, you know, a lot of, you'll never be able to launch it. How can he think about doing this in the 60s? And the thing is that, of course, you don't need a telescope to be filled. You can just make it of wires as long as the separation is smaller than 2 meters or whatever is the wavelength that you're interested in. And so the idea is just, it's a lot of wires that open up like an umbrella, and the shape is maintained through just rotation, which will give you a parabola. So it's a rotating thing made out of wires that orbits in space, and everything is worked out. And of course, if you can build such a thing, you could very nicely map all of this hydrogen, or also from the ground, if you think. So basically, the summary of this last part, we think that using the 21 centimeter line of hydrogen, a big part of our Hubble volume might be accessible to observations and to mapping, and then eventually to be used for large-scale structure studies. At the beginning, most of it will deal with the physics of this epoch in which the ionized hydrogen becomes ionized. But basically, it's the playing ground to see if this can be done. It has the potential because it's measuring a huge, much bigger volume than we have been able to map so far, of having a lot to say about cosmology. And that's what where some of us are spending some of the time. So that's it.
But is there, for example, can you look at how much feedback played a role in turning on the early stars and the early galaxies and so forth?
So, yes, I've spent actually a lot of my time thinking about the astrophysics in the last few years, because that's what we will learn at the beginning. And you might ask the question of all these astrophysical complications, what are the things that are really relevant, or can I simplify the problem? It turns out that you can simplify the problem, and you can figure out various combinations of parameters that are the most important ones, which are basically the number of ionizing photons you emit per hydrogen in the universe. The other one, that will just tell you how far along of this epoch organization is. And so a lot of things get lumped into that parameter. The second thing that's more important is what is the clustering properties of these sources, how they are distributed, what's their correlation function. And the other one that is important is how clumped the matter that is being ionized is at the time, because if it's more clumped, it means that the densities get higher and there can be more recombination. So you need more than one photon to ionize, to finally ionize the atom, because there's some chance of ionizing and recombining. So we've spent quite a while trying to understand in this set of parameters what these observations can tell us and what we expect for these parameters and so on. So I think there's quite a lot to be learned about astrophysics.
What about the place of particle alignment axis of view, which presumably is still simply the W3 theta.
Yes, it's all there, because well, if it wasn't there, it would be a huge embarrassment for WMAP, because nothing is supposed to change on this scale. The noise of the experiment is negligible on those scales. It's just, they're measuring those modes better, but they already had them so well, nothing should change. Now, I don't particularly pay much attention on those things for the following reason, and I don't doubt I was in one of these papers that found one of these things, but for the most part, I don't think it's very important. Because so one thing is, you repeat the procedure that they describe in the paper, you will get what they describe in the paper. So for the most part, I'm not claiming that they have made a mistake.
This one very young?
What?
This one very
young. I was with Max in about some alignment of the lower order multiples. So I mean, we've seen anyway. So that is true. However, these are all a posteriori things, and they are not something motivated from anywhere. So if you try, you may try and look for a lot of things. You sometimes will find them, and it's very impossible to figure out what's the chances that you should have found that, because you don't know how many things you've actually tried. And you and the community as a whole, nobody says, I've looked for some crazy thing and I found nothing. Okay? Because when they give you some percentage of probability in which this is unlikely, what they do is run simulations of a Gaussian random field and ask the question, if you were to look for this, how many times would you have found it, okay? But that's not what's happening. I mean, they've looked for many things, and then you have to. So to the extent that they have no motivation and it's just a two sigma thing, I don't worry about it. Once if the probability gets really low by dividing the probability by multiplying by a factor of a few, which if I think people have looked for 10 things, you still would not change the fact that there's something weird. But nothing has crossed that threshold for me.
Could you comment? Two questions. Could you comment on the prospects for measuring curvature?
Yes.
And the other one, related question, is there any particular difficulties in measuring tensor modes at very, very low L?
At very low L or high L?
Low L.
Low L. So measuring curvature, you have to do it. You have to measure. So the way we are measuring curvature or lambda is by measuring a distance. And those distances are typically an integral of the Hubble constant over time from today until the epoch of when you're observing whatever you're observing. So they typically depend, for example, if your two parameters are curvature and lambda, on both of them. So you need at least two separate distances in order to constrain both parameters. So we have those two distances. One of them can be the distance that you infer from the location of the peaks in the CMB. And the other distance might be either the distance to supernovae, or it could be the distance to the equivalent of these peaks in the CMB, but instead of in the CMB, in the matter power spectrum, the so-called baryonic-acoustic oscillations. And the other option is through gravitational lensing, for example, that also depends on distances. But I think through using these baryonic acoustic oscillations seems to me at the moment the most promising case, and people are thinking about surveys in which you would measure that distance quite much more accurately. And they talk about measuring the curvature to a part in a thousand or a few parts per thousand. And I think this is reasonable in the next several years through this method. And similar things might happen with the supernovae. So I wouldn't be surprised by another factor of a few improvement in these determinations. And in measuring the low L's, tensor modes at the low L's, I'd say that at the low L's usually, depends on whether you are doing it through this fitting procedure that's been done now through polarization. But the problem is usually always the same, and it's that low L, very low L, is something about the full sky. Okay, so you need a full sky experiment. But even a full sky experiment, we never get to measure the full sky because, for example, we need to take out the galaxy. And also, for example, in the case of polarization, there's still a lot of uncertainty as to how polarized the foregrounds of the galaxy are and how much of the galaxy we need to cut, how big the cut we need to do, especially if we want to get to the low levels for tessellations. So that is the big problem always for measuring. So at the moment, it's not known in the case of foregrounds how much this would damage you or what is the fraction of the sky that is clean. And that's the big unknown if you just want to go for LM2 or 3. Until we have better observations of that, I don't know.
So this is another naive question from the quantum information guy. When I build a reflecting telescope with a parabolic mirror, the incoming radiation is coherently concentrated.
Yes, exactly.
When you do your local electric field measurements, that's not.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's why we need to exactly this is what we have to do. So you have your telescope. It's such that when you take the light that's reflected here and the light that reflects, they add coherently all at this point, and that's what determines your shape, the best possible parabolic shape, for example. Other option, which is what this is going to do, is to just put antennas here and record the electric field and by hand add the delay in the phase such that you coherently add all of the things that come from one direction by adding. So this is for you adding a delay of this guy relative to this guy in the path because of the shape. So we don't have this shape, and so we will record the electric field and add the same delay to image what's coming from this direction. Add some other delay to like things from here, you would image there, So we are trying to recreate the telescope in the computer by adding delays by the computer, okay? So that's why you need to record the electric field as a function of time and add all of these delays to build up all of, it's a lot of computations. That's the idea.
So you can reconstruct the sort of classical electromagnetic wave coherence that way.
Yes.
But if we were dealing with really small numbers of photons, like one or two, then you'd be breaking the quantum coherence.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if that has any.
Yes, radio waves. You are in an incredibly classical regime. You have so many photons that I wouldn't want to dare to tell you the number because I would screw up. But it's like a lot.
Suppose this experiment is done. Would you expect a correlation between places that are bright at 21 centimeters compared to the ones in the microwave background?
Yes. So there are effects that would give you so for one thing, the two are in different places in the universe, right? So in that map. You have your microwave background, and you have, say, measure the full sky in this other method. So you're looking at things that are in different places. So what can give you correlations are basically two things. One, if you look on the very larger scales, a very large wavelength mode can affect both of them at the same way. And so on the very large scales, you might expect something like that. And then the other option is that as the CMB light travels through this region, there is some process that changes its temperature or adds something to it, such that when we think we are seeing things from here, we're also seeing a sum of things from both places. And that would be correlated. And so there are such things like, for example, because of the existence of the cosmological constant, the gravitational potential changes with time, and so changes the frequency, the energy of the photons as they travel along, depending on whether they pass through a hotspot of density or an overdensity. So this is called the ISW effect. So the ISW will correlate the two things. There's also gravitational lensing. So when we look in this direction, a mass here will deflect the photon and change what I see. So that will also give you. So all of those correlations are expected to be present. And some of them might have quite interesting information about the distribution of matter.
In the L equals 2 of the CMB, I think about half of that contribution is coming from ISW. So are we going to ever know enough about this to get, you know, the L equals 2 with ISW subtracted? Or are we not going to know this well enough?
Yes, so that I think is true. You might, maybe Raish knows better than me how much you might expect to be able to predict the ISW with. Probably you can know, you can, if you have a perfect thing, you can. The ISW only comes from the redshift 1 on, so it's not necessarily this technique, but maybe measuring galaxies. So you may get 90% of it or something like that. The other option is to look at the polarization of the CMB, which is not affected by the ISW, but that is affected by ionization. So, but maybe we can model that out. So I don't know.
So if this 21-centimeter stuff works out, how much would you be able to say about the value of the cosmological constant at a redshift around 15?
Probably this very much depends on whether the cosmological constant is a cosmological constant or something else. Because if it's a cosmological constant, it's doing nothing at this
point. Let's assume that it could be bigger, for example.
Yeah, if it could be bigger, so in principle, you can measure growth of structure between these times. And so if it's big enough to be a comparable contribution, so if it's affecting the Hubble constant in some, then you could tell. But not probably at the level that is expected if it's a cosmological constant. So I haven't tried quantitatively. I've tried cases where the cosmological constant is a cosmological constant, so I cannot say anything. But I didn't try others. So.
But you get a reasonable precision if it was comparable to the Hubble scale.
Yes, and with these futuristic things, you have a lot of precision. So even if it's maybe a percent or something like that.
So if you understand the reionization history better using 21 centimeter, does that feed back into inflationary parameters? That seems to be the first thing that will come out of 21 centimeter.
Yes. In principle, it could be. I don't know, given these first experiments are, we call them demonstrators, so they're just there to see the signal. We see something, that's the goal. So. With those, probably not, but with the next generation, you might indeed map how and then tau, you would need to figure out from the CMB, you would figure out. But by that time, it may well be that we have no tau from the polarization of the CMB much better than we know it now. So the degeneracies are no longer an issue. Either. Mm-hmm. Say, if this happens by the time Planck flies, then maybe we already know it as good as we need to know.
Actually, so I just wanted to make a comment as to early dark energy. So we already know it's from late time observations, less than 2%. So you don't even have to go to early times to be with that constraint. And just that comes from the cumulative effect on the growth of a structure during the dark era. What is it called? Dark ages. Yeah. So you don't even have to go that early from Lyman alpha fires, for example, in case the early dark energies should be less than 2%. You can probably do much better if you have 21 centimeters.
What range of redshifts does this dark ages span?
Anything before redshift of 2. So if it should be less than 2%.
I mean, so if lambda was, for example, changing in sign, then the integrated effect.
Yeah, that's true. So I assume if there was a constant fraction.
No.
Yes, you can certainly do a redshift evolution. If there is a non-trivial redshift dependent, we can do it this way.
Any other questions from Matthias? Let's thank him again.